Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Heart of the Matter. Some time back, I asked a close friend of mine, Reverend Ivan Foster, if he would be interested in explaining for all of you the history of the British province of Ulster, also known as Northern Ireland. Now, most Americans know very little, if anything, about Ulster, its history and its struggles, including that period known as the Troubles in the 1960s and 70s. In this day and age in America, most Americans believe that all the people in Ireland, on that island, are Roman Catholic Irish, knowing nothing of the Ulster Scots. Yet, many of us have Ulster Scot ancestors. Reverend Foster has put together a series of historical teachings for us, a series titled A History of Ireland as it Relates to the Ulster Scots, and which encompasses political and religious events, including revivals. Now, this week and the following 2 weeks, we will be airing that series. Ivan Foster is a retired minister of the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster, which is a separate denomination from the Free Presbyterian Church of North America, though the second owes its founding and has ties to the first. This brother is a tried, true, faithful minister of the Lord Jesus Christ, who has fought many a tough battle over the years, contending for the faith once delivered unto the saints. As I said earlier, the title of this history series you are going to be hearing is A History of Ireland as it Relates to the Ulster Scots. The subtitle of today's presentation is From Patrick to the Rebellion of 1641. Now here's Reverend Ivan Foster.
It has been rightly said that history is, in truth, his story. That is, the story of God's providential dealings in the affairs of our forefathers. For that reason, I personally love to study and read history. The gospel of Christ came to Ireland over 1,500 years ago. Despite many attempts by Satan and his agents, God has been pleased to maintain his truth in this land. Records of the early period of Ireland's history are scant. Much that is termed history is in fact fairy tale and myth. Amidst the fairy tales and what purports to be history are undoubted references to historical events, though distorted and exaggerated. Dr. W. D. Killen, the great Irish Presbyterian historian of the 19th century, wrote of the records that are available, and I quote, "All existing memorials concur to prove that Western Europe was peopled from the East, and the language of the Celts, the earliest colonists, is still inscribed on the Seine and the Rhone, the Alps and the Apennines. Ireland, where this tongue is yet spoken by a portion of the population, can produce records describing the succession of its kings extending back to a very remote antiquity. And though these documents contain many errors and absurdities, the reader may see that they often embody historical materials exaggerated or distorted in the course of transmission. According to them, all the island, at first uninhabited, was occupied by successive importations of strangers of Oriental origin." End of quotation. That is taken from Dr. Killen's book, The Old Catholic Church, page 303. The religion of ancient Ireland was that of Druidism, a religion with an abundance of priests and which chiefly centred upon the worship of the sun. It had strong overtones of the Baal worship we read of in the Bible. There are records that indicate some knowledge of the gospel was found amongst the people of Ireland shortly after the time of its entrance into England. Just when was the beginning of the gospel in Ireland? Well, early in the 4th century, Constantine the Great had professed faith in the gospel, though subsequent history showed that his conversion was not a genuine work of God's grace, but rather a mere embracing of some external practices. His campaign of enforced conversion, or Christianizing of the nations he conquered clearly evidenced the bogus nature of his own supposed conversion to Christ. However, during his reign, the true message of Christ enjoyed a greater freedom. It was at this time that some say that it gained an entrance into England, and thereafter it would have been carried across the sea to Ireland, since there was considerable commercial traffic between the two islands. In truth, however, the gospel would have reached the British Isles early in the 2nd century. In the 5th century, a French writer wrote of Pope Celestine sending Palladius to the Irish believing in Christ. This was in AD 431. It is clear that by this date there were those who believed in Christ in Ireland. By this time, the Bishop of Rome had already become a superior person within the framework of Christendom. Rome was the capital of Christendom. His sending of an envoy to Ireland was an attempt to increase his authority. It is also to be noted that Ireland was considered of sufficient importance as to merit an attempt to bring it under the rule of the Bishop of Rome. Palladius had previously been the Archdeacon of Rome. He is considered to have been a Briton, and being about 60, he may well have welcomed such an appointment. He set out for Ireland accompanied by many attendants, and as one Roman Catholic historian would have us believe, an ample supply of relics. Palladius, however, had little success. The official story is that he was driven from Ireland by a minor chieftain and forced to flee to Scotland. He met with little success there also, and about a year after commencing his task, died of a fever. The official account goes on to say that the Pope then sent over Patrick, who had great success and saw the land won for the Pope and for the gospel. However, we have to underline that such an account is utterly false. While there is much that is mere fancy among the historical documents of Ireland, there are two that everyone accepts. Those two are the Confession of Patrick and his letter. From these we can glean certain facts which, when coupled with other items of information that are available, give us the more likely account of what happened to Palladius and his attempt to claim Ireland for the Pope. From Patrick's confession, we learn that Patrick was not in Ireland to carry out the will of the Pope. Were he sent by Celestine, as Rome would claim, then that is one matter that Patrick would mention when giving an account of how he came to Ireland. Patrick, however, makes no mention whatever of the Pope, or of Rome, or of being sent by Celestine. His call to Ireland was a simple call sent of God. His language is as straightforward on this matter as that which you would hear today in a fundamentalist meeting. For a number of very good reasons, it is believed that Patrick died on the 17th of March 465. Likewise, it is believed that he laboured for 60 years in Ireland. That means he was in Ireland 25 years before Palladius arrived. The Bishop of Rome's claim of being the chief bishop was not universally accepted back then. The drift away from primitive simplicity was undoubtedly on, but the gross errors that prevailed in the Dark Ages were only beginning to emerge and find acceptance with the people. In France, particularly in that part called then Britain, and from which Patrick may well have come, there was resistance to the Bishop of Rome's claims of universal jurisdiction. Consequently, it fits in with the picture of Palladius being rejected in Ireland, not by a minor chieftain, but by the converts generally, because they rejected the attempts by the Bishop of Rome to bring them under his jurisdiction. Following its first planting, the gospel was carried by men whose hearts the Lord had touched into many neighbouring countries: Scotland, England, Wales, France, Germany, Switzerland, and further. May the land, now associated with terror and strife and anarchy and bloodshed, become known again by the title it was then given, the land of saints and scholars. There is much written about Patrick that is utterly and entirely fictitious. We can, however, be reasonably sure concerning his faith in Christ and the doctrines that he preached. There exist today, as I've said, two of his writings accepted by all scholars. One is his confession, and from that confession we learn that his father was a deacon, the son of Potitus, a gospel minister. Where Patrick was actually born is something of a mystery. England, Scotland, Wales, and even France all claim to be the place of his birth. In his confession, he tells us that he came from a village called Bonavem Tabernae. Where that village was is difficult now to say. It would appear that a very likely place was somewhere in Roman Britain. Very possibly he came from a place now called Kilpatrick, that is, the Church of Patrick, near Dumbarton in the Firth of Clyde in Scotland. At the age of 16, Patrick was taken captive by Irish raiders and sold as a slave in Ireland. Slemish Mountain in County Antrim, in the northern part of the island, was where he tended the flocks of sheep of the one who became his master. Wherever he was born, there is one thing we can be sure of, and that is he was born again in Ireland. It was there that the wayward youth repented and sought the God of his fathers and received Christ by simple faith. After a period of slavery, he managed to escape and return home. But he was not to remain there very long, for it was there, like Paul, he received a call. He had a remarkable dream in which he saw a man coming to him from Ireland, whose name was Victor Icaeus, carrying with him letters, and the letters began with the heading, The Voice of the Irish. And as he began to read one of the letters, he heard a voice that cried, We entreat thee, holy youth, to come and walk henceforth amongst us. Patrick took this to be the call of God, and so returned to the land where once he had been a slave. But now he came as a preacher of the gospel, to set men free from the darkness that enslaved this land. Patrick had great success in the preaching of the gospel. Many churches were started, and many thousands were won to Christ. His preaching career covered a period of time in the mid-5th century. He is believed to be buried in Downpatrick, in County Down, in Northern Ireland. It is important to understand that though the Roman Catholic Church today claims him as her apostle to Ireland, and his name and his statues adorn many of the great Roman Catholic mass houses in Ireland, there is nothing more clear than that Patrick's theology was as far removed from popery as heaven is from hell. It is a simple matter of reading his confession, and one will see that Rome's claim that he came to Ireland as an emissary of the Pope is entirely false. Neither is it true to say that Patrick was responsible for the organizing of a church in Ireland that was prelatic in its organization. Patrick claims in his writings to have established 365 churches in Ireland, appointing 365 bishops, or one bishop, for each church. It's clear that far from following Episcopalianism, Patrick followed primitive Bible Christianity. Although Ireland sank down into that same darkness that engulfed the rest of Europe during that period which became known as the Dark Ages, the decline was not as rapid in Ireland as it was elsewhere. The gospel light was still shining in Ireland with remarkable clarity when it had greatly dimmed in many other European countries. From Ireland there went out many great missionary preachers. Among them was Columba, who centred his activities in Iona, an island off the west coast of Scotland. Columbanus went to preach in France. Gallus, one of the disciples of Columbanus, became a well-known evangelist in Switzerland. Another preacher of the gospel with Irish origins was Killeen. He evangelized in the Würzburg area of Germany, and in another part of Germany a work was carried on by a preacher called Fridolin the Traveller. Sadly, Ireland also eventually succumbed to the advancing darkness of Romanism. One event that established Roman Ireland was the invitation by Pope Adrian IV to the English King Henry II to invade Ireland and bring it into submission to the English crown and thus into submission to the Pope of Rome. In the light of the present political situation in Ireland, and in Northern Ireland in particular, it is essential that we bear in mind that England first became politically involved in Ireland at the invitation of the Pope. It is ironic that the very system which gives birth to such strong anti-British, anti-English feelings through its schools and churches, and which in turn is responsible for the fanaticism of Roman Catholic terrorism, should have been responsible for the invasion of Ireland by the English in the first place. When England served the cause of the Pope, it was welcome in Ireland. But once England became Protestant, she was labelled the wicked invader. Such is the lying deceit of Romanism. But subjugation under popery does not end God's story in this little island. The simple gospel of Patrick continued to be proclaimed in Ireland long after his death in the latter part of the 5th century. But with the spread of papal ambition, the Bishop of Rome was anxious to bring Ireland into its pale. This encroachment was opposed by Irish ecclesiastics, so that for centuries it remained purer than any other country in Christendom. But little by little it acceded to the unceasing demands of papal Rome. However, this did not happen overnight, nor without a battle of resistance. In 1110, a synod was convened under the presidency of the Pope's legate, Gilibert. This is known in history as the Synod of Rathbrechel. It decreed that the whole land was to be placed under the government of 23 bishops and 2 archbishops. This fact is recorded by the Roman Catholic historian John Lanigan. Despite the authoritative character of this synod, the arrangements it decreed were not universally carried out. More than 40 years later, another papal legate, Cardinal Papora, was sent over from Rome, and another synod was convened and met at Kells in County Meath. Again, Ireland was divided into dioceses. This time the number was increased to 38. That the church structures brought into existence in the days of Patrick were still operating in some places in Ireland is evident in the continued parish or village bishoprics. For this, Kells Synod passed a resolution that, on the death of village bishops, there should be chosen to succeed in their stead archpresbyters to be appointed by the diocesans, who should superintend the clergy and the laity in their respective districts. It is clear from this that the non-prelatic system of church government instituted by Patrick fought long and died hard. The Synod of Kells had followed the Synod of Rathbrechel because, although nearly half a century had passed, the decrees of the earlier synod had not been generally carried out throughout Ireland. But Rome was determined to have her way in Ireland. Accordingly, she resorted to the means she so often employed, the arm of secular government. The King of England at that time was Henry II. He was a loyal vassal of Rome's Pope Adrian IV, the only Englishman ever to sit on the papal throne. His real name was Nicholas Breakspear. In 1155, some 3 years after the Synod of Kells, Pope Adrian issued a bull in which he authorised Henry II to invade Ireland. The wording of the bull merits us quoting at least some of it, as it appears in Dr. Thomas Hamilton's History of the Presbyterian Church, published in 1887. The quotation reads as follows: "His Holiness held it right that for the extending of the borders of the church, restraining the progress of vice, for the correction of manners, the planting of virtue, and the increase of the Christian religion, you enter that island and execute therein whatever shall pertain to the honour of God and the welfare of the land, and that the people of that land receive you honourably. and reverence you as their Lord, the rites of their churches still remaining sacred and inviolate, and saving to St. Peter the annual pension of one penny from every house. This act by the Pope has naturally caused much quibbling by those anxious to protect the papacy from the repercussions of the invasion of Ireland by the English army. But try as they might, the defenders of Rome cannot eradicate from history the fact that papal greed and ambition lay behind the interference of the English crown in Ireland's affairs, and that nation being handed over most audaciously to England. Ireland has complained much ever since, but few Roman Catholics are willing to recognise the true villain of the peace, Papal Rome, in the form of Pope Adrian IV. Although the papal bull was issued in 1155, it was 1171 before Henry was ready to invade. In that year, he landed at Waterford, and so began England's sovereignty over the island of Ireland. In truth, English authority extended little further than the area known as the Peel, an area on the east coast stretching from a little south of Dublin northward to Dundalk. The rest of the country was largely left to its own devices. The Romish bishops and priests enforced their rule, now having the support of the English army, and the people were made to submit to the errors of Rome and surrender what remained of the primitive gospel teachings of Patrick. The regime of the Roman priests is exemplified by what Dr. Hamilton tells us of the behaviour of three prelates in his book. The quotation reads, "We read of one besieging a brother bishop in his own cathedral, loading him with chains, and immuring him in a dungeon, from which he barely escaped with his life. Of another, who earned for himself the significant nicknames of Burn Bill and Scorch Villain, from his having burned all his tenants' title deeds, of which he had fraudulently got possession, and of a third, starving to death six persons whose property he had got into his hands." End of quotation. A very great change had come upon Ireland from the days of gospel blessing under Patrick. Misery prevailed across the island. What may be called the first step toward the reformation of the affairs of the nation came in 1537, when the Irish Parliament rejected the authority of the Pope and declared the King, Henry VIII, supreme head on earth of the Church of Ireland. But it was a change in name only. No spiritual change is the outcome of parliamentary decrees or kingly proclamation. Although the spirit of true reformation was underway in England, in Ireland such announcements were seen as but the enforcement of the religious views of the invader. Had only wiser measures been taken for the instructing of the Irish people in the scriptures, as were taken in England and Scotland, then the history of the island would have been very different indeed. As it was, the civil penal laws could not have endeared the Irish people to the English administration, but rather ensured that the religion, which had the endorsement of the same Parliament, which passed such harsh restrictions and penalties against the native people, would not be viewed with any favour. Little wonder, then, the Reformation which strode forward on mainland Britain should make such little progress in Ireland. The short reign of Henry VIII's son, the godly Edward VI, saw some advances, but his six-year reign from 1547 to 1553 was too short for the gospel to advance too far. Furthermore, he was followed by the one rightly called Bloody Mary, Mary I of England, who reigned from 1553 until 1558, and it was indeed a time of blood for the cause of Christ. Over 280 Protestants were burned to death during her reign, with many more dying in prison. Of course, the Protestants of Ireland did not escape her hatred. She set about undoing whatever little progress had been made under Edward VI, and Romanism resumed its dominance. Mary instructed the civil powers, and we quote, "by their example and all good means possible, to advance the honour of God and the Catholic faith, to set forth the honour and dignity of the Pope's Holiness and the See Apostolic of Rome, and from time to time be ready with their aid and secular force at the request of all spiritual ministers and ordinaries, to punish and repress all heretics and lollards and their damnable sects, opinions, and errors. My quotation is taken from Richard Cox's History of Ireland. The Irish Parliament passed an act in 1556 which declared that all persons preaching or teaching, or evidently suspected of preaching or teaching, against the Catholic faith might be arrested by the bishop of the diocese, and on their refusal to renounce their faith, be delivered to the secular arm and burnt for the terror of others. Irish terrorism against Protestantism has a long history. The story is told of one of Mary's emissaries, a Dr. Cole, Dean of St. Paul's in London, being dispatched with fresh orders to put down Protestantism in Ireland. He stayed overnight in Chester, near Liverpool, and being heard boasting of the royal commission he carried and its purpose by the proprietor of the inn, the good woman, out of a concern for Protestant friends in Dublin, removed the royal commission from the box amongst his luggage and replaced it with a deck of playing cards. The switch was not noticed until Dr. Cole sought to present the box containing the royal commission to the Lord Deputy of Ireland. What consternation ensued when the pack of cards was discovered with the knave of clubs uppermost. The angry dean hastened back to London for a fresh commission and was on his way back to Ireland once more when Mary died. So by the merciful hand of Providence, many Irish Protestants were spared the sufferings endured by their English counterparts under her reign. Elizabeth I, Good Queen Bess, as she became known, now came to the throne. However, the swing of the pendulum could not but influence the Irish people in an evil manner. To see Romanism overturned and Protestantism established, and then Protestantism put down and Romanism once again restored, and now the tables turned yet again, could only breed contempt for many of the ruling ecclesiastics. Those who had been zealous Romanists had become equally zealous Protestants under Henry and Edward, only to turn turtle once again under Mary's regime. Some were even so bold as to change their coats a third time when Elizabeth came to the throne. Such vacillations could bring derision only upon those guilty of it in the eyes of the native people. It is little wonder, then, that rebellion and civil war marked Elizabeth's reign in Ireland. However, before she died, that rebellion had been effectively dealt with militarily. The land entered upon a period of relative calm, and a measure of prosperity ensued. With the flight of the earls, the departure of the Gaelic chieftains from Ireland to seek refuge on the continent in 1607, a new day dawned in the land. Their power broken on the battlefield, they and thousands of their followers departed their native land. The turmoil at the north of the island of Ireland had long endured as a result of the defiance of these rebellious leaders was now largely at an end. The government took steps to populate the large tracts of land that had been forfeited to the crown by the fugitive earls. The people the government chose for such a project were Scots and English settlers, many from the rough, tough border country that lay between England and Scotland. They were an ideal stock to plant in the northern province of Ulster. They could be expected to develop the natural resources of the country by their industry and enterprise in a fashion the native population had failed to do for centuries. They could also be expected to provide a faithful and loyal people ready to protect the interests of Protestantism. The Ulster Plantation, as the enterprise became known, proved to be one of the most significant events in the history of Ulster, and indeed Ireland, and especially in the cause of Christ's gospel in this island. Early in the 17th century, the Ulster Plantation began. The main agent of this project was Sir Arthur Chichester. He was appointed Lord Deputy of Ireland in 1605. The plantation was carried out in the following manner. The lands that had been forfeited by the banished rebel chiefs, led by O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone, and O'Donnell, Earl of Tyrconnell, were now divided into lots of 1,000, 1,500, and 2,000 acres. These lots were allocated to settlers conforming to certain conditions. The occupiers of the larger portions were bound within 4 years to build a castle and a bawn. The bawn was a walled enclosure with fortified towers at the corners. Within this enclosure was the castle or dwelling house, and it provided security for the occupants and their animals from the bands of marauders still blighting the countryside. Well-preserved ruins of these castles are to be found in many places still in Northern Ireland. They were also required to plant on their estates 48 able men, 18 years old and upward, of English or Scottish descent. Those of the second class, with smaller allotments, were obligated to build within 2 years a strong stone or brick house and bawn. Those of the third class were required to build a bawn. Both these classes were bound, furthermore, to plant an appropriate number of British families on their possessions and to have their houses furnished with a sufficiency of arms. Dr. Reid, in his History of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, gives greater details of the business-like arrangements underlying the plantation. It may be said here that the experiences obtained in the plantation by the Ulster Scots, as they later became known, stood them in good stead when many of them emigrated to the lands that were eventually to be known as the United States of America in the 1700s. It might also be said that what happened in Ulster in the early 17th century was every bit as legal and legitimate as the planting of the vast areas of the American colonies. Irish republicanism still term the Protestant descendants of the planters as foreigners and invaders, with no rightful claim to the lands of the northern counties, where they have lived now for over 400 years. Strangely, these charges are taken up by Roman Catholic sympathisers and supporters of Irish republicanism in the United States of America. It is most ironic that people like the Irish American political dynasty, the Kennedys, and those of that ilk, have no more just claim to their possessions in the United States than do the Ulster Protestants to their possessions in Northern Ireland. Indeed, the Ulster Protestant has a claim of greater legitimacy in that he has been in the land for four centuries. The settlers faced harsh conditions in this wild and long neglected land, which was nothing short of a wilderness. Wolves and the sudden silent arrow fired from the bow of an Irish native served to remind the settler that he was in an inhospitable land. However, diligent labours soon saw trees felled, houses built, fields formed and ploughed and planted, and crops harvested and animal husbandry organised. The settlers held their ground against the adversities they faced, and soon the plantation areas were transformed from the wastelands that they had been and took on the appearance of the more organised fields from which they had moved across the 20-mile narrow North Channel. Settlements such as Londonderry, Coleraine, Ballymena, Carrickfergus, Belfast, Newtownards, Bangor, Donaghadee, Killyleagh, and many others were established or further developed from primitive hamlets. Belfast, for instance, now the capital of Northern Ireland, was merely a handful of fishermen's huts before the plantation, but soon became the beginnings of the flourishing port that it is today. Ulster became a place of refuge for those faithful Christians who followed in the footsteps of the Scots reformer John Knox, who died in 1572. Attempts were being made in Scotland by James VI of Scotland to reintroduce prelacy and overthrow Presbyterianism. He had, at the start of his reign, as in the case with so many kings and rulers, professed the strongest allegiance to the gospel and to Presbyterianism. However, the Lord has not said, "Put not your trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help," Psalm 146, verse 3, without good cause. James desired a more malleable church than that of the stiff-backed, stubborn Presbyterian. He had succeeded to the English throne in 1603 following the death of Queen Elizabeth. His true nature was seen in his threat to the Puritans of England. "I'll make them conform, or I'll harry them out of the land." This boded ill for both Scotland and England. Andrew Melville, Knox's bold successor, was committed to the Tower of London for a period of 4 years, and prelacy was imposed upon Scotland. The persecution of Presbyterians continued on the ascension of Charles I to the throne. Archbishop Laud was the chief instrument of the king to oppress God's people. It was in these circumstances that refugees from this persecution sought refuge in Ulster. In the wise providence of God, Scotland's loss was Ulster's great gain. While Presbyterianism existed in Ireland from long before the Ulster plantation, nevertheless, it is a fact that Presbyterianism took a firm root and its present structures grew during the period of the plantation. In 1613, Edward Bryce began his ministry in Broad Island, which lies between Carrickfergus and Larne in County Antrim. He had been the minister in Drymen, Stirlingshire, but had to flee his native land because of his opposition to prelacy. The Bishop of Down, of the Church of Ireland, took a sympathetic view of men such as Bryce and permitted him to exercise his ministry. Such sympathy was, in a large part, due to the influence of James Usher, the primate of the Church of Ireland, who had pronounced Presbyterian doctrinal affinities. Under him, the Church of Ireland adopted in 1615 articles of religion which were thoroughly Calvinistic and made no mention, strangely enough, of the three orders of bishops, priests and deacons so beloved of Episcopalians. Another refugee was Mr. Hubbard, an English nonconformist forced to flee from London. He preached at Carrickfergus from about 1621, but sadly died at the beginning of 1623. He was greatly beloved of his people. One of the most stable men to come to Ulster to promote the Presbyterian cause was Robert Blair. He had been a professor in Glasgow College, but forced to flee because of his refusal of prelacy, the rule by bishops. He became minister of Bangor in 1623. James Hamilton, a nephew of Lord Clandeboy, became minister of Ballywalter in 1625. In Holywood, Robert Cunningham had taken up the ministry of the gospel. Josiah Welsh, grandson of John Knox, had settled at Temple Patrick, just 6 miles northeast of Newton Abbey. John Livingstone became minister at Killinshi in County Down. These are but a few of the godly men who, by the mercy of God, were brought over to Ulster, and under him were instruments in the saving of souls and the advance of the cause of Christ, becoming the fathers of Presbyterianism in Ireland. The River 6 Mile Water rises in the hills above Larne in County Antrim and flows towards Ballynewer, Ballyclare, Temple Patrick, and then empties into Loch Ness. It is a river that has long been associated with a wonderful work of grace amongst the early planters and their ministers. For the valley through which that river flows experienced a wonderful move of the Holy Ghost. The Reverend James Glendenning was minister at Carrickfergus. He was a good man, according to his contemporaries, but not over-gifted in the pulpit. He was advised by the Reverend Robert Blair, who used to cross Belfast Loch from County Down to Carrickfergus to assist him. He was advised, they say, by Blair to leave Carrickfergus, then the leading town in Ulster, and seek a more isolated country charge better suited to his capabilities. This he did, moving to Oldstone, not far from the town of Antrim. The poor man was later described as becoming distracted, or what we would likely today refer to as one suffering from depression, if not delusion. Yet this was the man who was to become God's instrument in the beginnings of a great work of revival. Truly, it is not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Zechariah chapter 4, verse 6. At Oldstone, Glendenning's preaching greatly awakened the consciences of many in his district, for he had preached strongly the terrors of God's judgments against the lewdness and ungodly sinfulness of the people. The people of the parish fell into a state of anxiety and distress of soul. But poor Mr. Glendenning was not skilled at applying the medicine of the gospel. Multitudes were thus stricken down, and it was only when neighbouring ministers came to his aid in response to his requests that souls were led to find rest and pardon in the Lord Jesus Christ. Meetings to preach the gospel and instruct inquirers were organized, and the work of revival spread to neighboring areas, and undoubtedly multitudes were converted to Christ. It was called at the time a bright and hot sunblink of the gospel. But the sky was soon to darken. The prevailing attitude throughout Britain and Ireland at this time was anti-nonconformity. But the devil had worse in store for Christ's flock. That was the terrible rebellion of 1641. The objective of the Roman Catholic rebels was the eradication of all Protestants in Ireland and the restoration of the lands that had been forfeited a generation earlier. The rebellion began on Saturday, October the 23rd, 1641. It began with an attempt to seize Dublin Castle, the seat of the British administration, but providentially was frustrated. However, the force and power of the rebellion moved northward and spent itself in Ulster, Dungannon, Newry, Monaghan, Dromore in County Down, and many other towns were seized by the Roman Catholic forces of Sir Phelim O'Neill, the rebel leader. Enniskillen, the chief town of County Fermanagh, was safeguarded against the Roman Catholic rebels and was able to forward information to Londonderry, Limavady and Coleraine, which saved these towns also. Carrickfergus, Lisburn and Belfast were also secured against the rebel. However, outside these strongholds, Ulster became a veritable field of blood. Whole Protestant families, including infants, were slaughtered. Others, stripped naked, perished behind hedges, seeking what shelter they could find in one of the coldest winters that could be remembered. The River Blackwater in County Tyrone ran red with the blood of the slaughter, as the Roman Catholic insurgents vent their hatred upon God's people. Infants had their brains dashed out before their horrified mothers. Others were flung alive into boiling pots of water or fed alive to pigs. Poor Protestants had their eyes gouged out, their hands or their ears cut off. 300 Protestant men, women and children were driven into a church at Loch Gall, and then daily victims were taken out to suffer outrage and be killed. 196 Protestants were drowned at Portadown Bridge. In one day, 1,000 were said to be killed in the same manner at that location. The worst of atrocities were reserved for Protestant ministers. The Reverend Thomas Murray of Killyleagh was crucified, and his 2 sons cut to pieces before their mother's eyes, before she was horribly mutilated and her tongue half cut out. The full details of the savagery performed upon Protestant children, women and men by these adherents of Roman Catholicism, who were commonly anointed by their priests and bishops before engaging in such devilry, are too distressing to relate. Suffice to say that full documentation of the wickedness of that Roman Catholic rebellion remains to this day. This is no hearsay that we quote. 32 volumes of sworn depositions still exist in the library of Trinity College, Dublin, and can even be accessed by the internet. All told, it was believed that many tens of thousands of Protestants were slaughtered. Indeed, there were those of highest authority who estimated the death toll as high as hundreds of thousands done to death. The 1641 rebellion was Ulster's St. Bartholomew's Massacre. It left a deep-seated dread of popery amongst Ulster Protestants. It stirred our fathers in 1912 to arm themselves in order to resist the British government's Home Rule Bill, which would have placed Ulster under Dublin and Roman Catholic rule. It was a sentiment which gave birth to Northern Ireland remaining British, while the rest of Ireland opted to leave the United Kingdom. Here in Ulster, we continue to say, God save us from popery. May the Lord in mercy hear that prayer.
You've been listening to Reverend Ivan Foster. Next week, we will air part 2 of A History of Ireland as it relates to the Ulster Scots.